Well, I thought this morning we'd have a little demonstration, kind of like a little enactment of the next part of the sutra. You ready? So you have to pay attention, because we're going to pretend that we're the characters in the sutra. So you're the pure assembly, and I'm going to play the part of... Well, I'll play several parts here because I have the book. I'll pretend that I'm the Buddha and Ananda and also Rahula, and you'll be the assembly, okay? Give you the easy job. So now you're all transformed into 1,250 pure practitioners whose outflows are purified. So then Buddha instructed Rahula, who, as you know, was his son, who also became one of his disciples. The Buddha instructed Rahula to strike the bell once. Okay, Buddha. And he asked Ananda, "Did you hear that?" And Ananda and the members of the great assembly all said, "We heard it." The bell ceased to sound, and the Buddha again asked, "Do you hear it now?" Ananda and the members of the great assembly all said, "We don't hear it." "Do you hear it now?" And all the members of the great assembly said, "Yes, we hear it." The Buddha asked Ananda, "What do you hear and what do you not hear?" Ananda and the members of the great assembly all said to the Buddha, "When the bell is rung, we hear it. Once the sound of the bell ceases, so that even its echo fades away, we do not hear it." "Is there sound now?" Ananda and the members of the great assembly said, "There is sound." "Is there sound now?" Ananda and the great assembly answered, "There is no sound now." "Is there sound now?" Ananda and the great assembly said together, "There is sound." The Buddha asked Ananda, "What is meant by sound and what is meant by no sound?" Ananda and the great assembly told the Buddha, maybe slightly annoyed by this time, I don't know. "When the bell is struck, Buddha, there is sound. Once the sound ceases and even the echo fades away, then we say there is no sound." Buddha then said to Ananda and the great assembly, "Why are you inconsistent in what you say?" The great assembly and Ananda then asked the Buddha, "In what way have we been inconsistent?" The Buddha said, "When I asked you if it was your hearing, you said it was your hearing. Then, when I asked you if it was sound, you said it was sound. I cannot ascertain from your answers if it is hearing or if it is sound. How can you not say that this is inconsistent? Ananda, when the sound is gone without an echo, you say there is no hearing. If there were really no hearing, the hearing nature would be extinguished. It would be just like dead wood. If then the bell were sounded again, how would you know it? If your hearing nature was gone, how would you know it when the bell was struck the second time? What you know to be there is the defiling object of sound. But could the hearing nature be there or not be there depending on your perception of its being there or not? If the hearing could really not be there, what would perceive that it was not? So, you know, things happen far away, but we don't say they're not happening just because we don't know they're not happening. We know that even though we're sitting here, different things are going on in the world. We don't say the world disappeared since we're sitting here. And yet, when the sound has gone away, we say there's no hearing. Just because we don't see it doesn't mean it isn't there. And what would be able to see it? How would we see something going on far away? We couldn't see it, and we couldn't hear or know about the hearing that was not being activated when there's no sound. And so, Ananda, the Buddha goes on, the sounds that you hear are what are subject to production and extinction, not your hearing. The arising and cessation of sounds cause your hearing nature to be as if there or not there. You are so upside down that you mistake sound for hearing. No wonder you are so confused that you take what is everlasting, the hearing, for what is annihilated, the sound, which comes and goes. Ultimately, you cannot say that there is no hearing nature apart from movement and stillness and from obstruction and penetration. Movement and stillness and obstruction and penetration are the conditions that give rise to a sound. You can't say that apart from them, there's no abiding nature of hearing. So that's a little demonstration that comes toward the end of Volume 4 of the Sutra. So this is almost the same story, of course, the same point that we heard earlier in the story of King Prasenajit, who, although his body was growing old and so forth, the nature of the seeing itself was not changing. In the same way here, although the sound is coming and going, the nature of hearing is not coming and going. So hopefully you appreciate this more and more with each day's passing as you're sitting, practicing intense listening to sound and to the silence of the sound also. And the point here is that the Buddha wants us to understand that in perception, to avoid becoming entangled in the object and to recognize that around and through and within our sensory experience is the bright, limitless consciousness that illuminates our lives and the whole world around us. And I think as you sit paying attention and listening, the perceptual world begins to take on that flavor. Then, the world-honored one took pity on Ananda and on those in the assembly with something left to study, as well as on living beings of the future, in order to help them transcend the world and become eyes for for the future. He rubbed the crown of Ananda's head with his Jambunada purple golden bright hand. This Buddha doesn't have regular hands. It's glowing purple golden hands. And he rubs Ananda's head in the gesture of loving kindness and intimacy. And instantaneously when he did that, all the Buddha lands in the 10 directions quaked in 6 ways. Imagine, you know, throughout, reverberating throughout the universes. I don't know what 6 ways would be, but 6 different ways. Thus come ones, in other words, Buddhas, as numerous as fine motes of dust, each dwelling in his or her respective world, each one of them emitted a precious light from the crown of their head. And at one and the same time, let's picture this now, is many, imagine a cloud of dust in the room here. Each one of those clouds of dust would have a little Buddha on it, and each Buddha would be emitting a ray from the top of their head. And that would, and that ray went from their own countries, wherever they were, far distant places, right here to the Jada Grove where the Buddha is sitting with his disciples, and anointed the crown of the thus come one's head. So all these Buddhas from all over the place are beaming this light beam, and it's hitting the Buddha right in the crown of his head. And that, when that happened, all those in the assembly obtained what they never had before. And then all these Buddhas spoke as if in a single voice, and they all said, "Good indeed, Ananda. You wish to recognize your innate ignorance that causes you to turn on the wheel of suffering, birth, and death endlessly. The origin of the knot of birth and death is simply your 6 sense organs and nothing else. You also want to understand Bodhi, enlightenment, so that you can quickly realize bliss, liberation, tranquility, and wonderful permanence. It too is your 6 sense organs and nothing else." So that's the end of that story, of the demonstration of hearing the sound of the bell, and that's how it ends up. Then, of course, as we've seen already many times before, after the commercial, Ananda comes back and says, "Buddha, I still don't understand." I mean, you know, what does it take, you know, for Buddha? I mean, all these Buddhas and light beams, I mean, my God, you know. I mean, I would have understood by now, wouldn't you? I think. But Ananda, he still doesn't understand. So he says, you know, "Teach us more." So then comes the next part where Buddha now, and I unfortunately I didn't have the props to get this one together, but Buddha then pulls out a big cloth, a beautiful cloth, and he begins to make knots in the cloth. He ties first one knot, and he says, you know, I won't go through it all, but what is this, Ananda? This is a knot. He ties another knot. What's this, another knot? He ties 6 knots in the pure white cotton cloth. And he said, "You know, Ananda, that this precious cloth of flowers, I guess it has flowers on it, is basically one strip. But when I made 6 ties in it, you said it had 6 knots. As you carefully consider this, you will see that the substance of the cloth is the same. It is the knots that make it seem different, but still it's one cloth. What do you think? The first knot I tied was called number 1. I asked you and you said it was the first knot, and so on, all the way up to the 6th knot. Now is the 6th knot also number 1? No, says Ananda. If there are 6 knots, the 6th knot is the 6th knot. It's not the first knot. So it is, the Buddha said. The 6 knots are not the same. Consider their origin. They are created from the one cloth. To confuse their order will not do. Your 6 sense organs are also like this. In the midst of ultimate sameness, conclusive differences arise. The Buddha said, you certainly dislike these six knots and would like there to be just one cloth. But how can that be done? Ananda said, as long as these knots remain, there will be grounds for argument about what is and what is not, and then suffering. Their very existence will lead to such distinctions as this knot not being that knot and that knot not being this one. But if, on this day, the Buddha were to untie them all so that no knots remain, then there will be no this and no that. There will not even be something called one. How much less can there be something called six? Then, after skipping some here, the Buddha sort of discusses the philosophical wider implications of this. He then says, getting back to the metaphor of the cloth, he pulls on one of the knots from the left end, and of course it draws tighter. And he says, Ananda, is this the way to untie the knot? No. Then he pulls it on the right side, and of course it draws still tighter. Is this the way to untie it? No. Well, then the Buddha says, how would you untie it? And Ananda said, world-honored one, you must untie the knots from their center. Then they will come undone. So it is. So it is, Ananda. If you want to get them undone, you have to untie them from the center. So I'll go on with this in a moment, but first, a footnote about this kind of style of the sutra. This, you can already tell, I think, from the parts that I've been quoting to you, and I've been leaving out most of the repetitions. But even so, you can see that there's a kind of formulaic, repetitive style of the sutra, which is why in the beginning I said that this all might be a little bit boring. Because very repetitive. In a way, when one point is made, it's then made formulaically in 12 or 15 or sometimes 25 different ways. And then the same point is made again using another metaphor, as you see in the case of the bell and King Prasenajit. So it's very formulaic and very repetitive, which is more or less the basic style of the Buddhist sutras. That's why it's true, you know, by modern standards of literature, it's kind of boring. And that's because, of course, these early sutras and all the later sutras were purported to be from the same timeless moment, so they took on the same style. But the early sutras were created out of an oral tradition. They weren't written, they were literally memorized and repeated over and over again. And memorizing and repeating texts is a very different thing from reading them. It's almost like you internalize, make them physical, and you perform them or sing them like songs. It's a different thing to sing a song and to read a poem or read a text. So that the texts weren't what we... The way we look at written material now, you know, it contains information, and we want more information and go on from there to the next thing and so forth. They weren't conceived of as vehicles for the transmission of knowledge or information, so much as physical, devotional, maybe even almost magical practices. The sutras were considered, you know, as devotional practices rather than as information or analysis. And even though nowadays we're so conditioned by I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of years of printed, you know, mass-produced texts, and even taking literacy for granted. Of course, in the days when the sutras were first written, literacy was a very strange and magical power for someone to be able to read, let alone write something. So we take all this for granted. It becomes very degraded, in a sense, in our conception. So it's you know, we have to realize the big difference between us and the people who first produced these sutras. But still, we can, and we have to, I think, study sutras in the spirit in which they were originally created, a devotional spirit, almost a physical act, not like ordinary reading. So the way to approach a sutra, to study a sutra, is quite different from other texts. Maybe to chant them or recite them, as is still done in some schools of Buddhism, or as I often encourage people, to just read for a certain amount of time after sitting, even if it's only 15 minutes, with the spirit of the same spirit as your sitting practice, rather than for learning or information. I was a couple years ago went to India and attended a teaching of His Holiness Dalai Lama in Bodh Gaya, a 5-day teaching that he gave on a Mahayana text. And the teaching consisted for 5 whole days of him reading the text out loud. Occasionally he would make a comment, but basically, you know, it was like this very, very thick text, 300 some pages. He just read it. I mean, I'm reading little parts here. He read the entire text and nothing else all day long for 5 days. And we were thinking, like, this is weird, you know, why didn't I just read it myself, you know, and take it home? And why would I go all the way to India to hear Dalai Lama reading it, you know, with all these thousands of people? But from the standpoint of the real meaning and the sense of these sutras, it makes perfect sense, because to hear Dalai Lama reading it is a kind of transmission of the text. That's the kind of language they use. They say Dalai Lama is now transmitting this text to the audience as a kind of initiation or transmission. That the text takes on a life in that kind of situation. So that's I just want to give you a flavor for the huge difference between how these texts are traditionally regarded and how we regard reading and writing and studying and so forth. And when we hear this kind of thing, this repetition, sort of rote repetition, it seems to us, we're beyond that. You know, we're so much more sophisticated than that. And we have minds that have been shaped by several hundred years of the powerful idea of progress and the development of things that are always changing, always new, and always improved. But of course, that's very much connected to a particular philosophy of time, a particular notion of time, which is, after all, just a notion. So I don't think repetition is archaic. I actually, one of my sayings is, repetition is the soul of religion. Religious practice is mostly about repetition. So no wonder the sutras are so repetitive. It's all about repetition. Ritual is really a study in repetition. You know, you repeat something over and over and over again until it's somehow, because it doesn't change, more or less, over and over and over again, you repeat it, any idea of progression of time sort of gets reduced almost by force until you sense that there really isn't any time anymore. And like service is like that to me. When I, you know, service is like, I can't tell, you know, am I in, you know, Samish Island? Am I in Mexico? Am I in space? Is it today? Is it yesterday? Is it 10 years ago? Is it 10 years from now? Nothing, none of these things like make any sense. Somehow there's a sense in which the chanting of the sutra is taking place in another time zone from the one that's marked by my calendar and my schedule and 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and so forth. Zazen itself is a repetition. You know, ritualized sitting in exactly the same way, time after time after time after time. And we think, you know, each of us thinks that we're also a new person not a repeated person, that our lives are novel and new. But sometimes I wonder about that, to tell you the truth. Maybe in a way it's true, but in a way it's not. For many, many years, I've always wondered, you know, you hear people talking. You ever, like, go to a restaurant and overhear people talking at the other tables? Or if you're on an airplane, you know, hear the different conversations. Sometimes I do that if I'm in a busy place and there's conversations. I listen to the conversations and I think to myself, I wonder how many things there actually are to talk about. How many things, you know, are there to talk about? So sometimes I make lists, you know, of all the possible topics of conversation. So we have food. We have money. People talk about money quite a bit, even though it's like totally made up, you know. But they talk, but it's very, you know, people talk about it a lot. How much does this cost? You go traveling, everybody's talking about, well, I got it for this, and how much was that, and how much was your ticket, you know. So there's food, there's money, there's the various myriad forms of entertainment and distraction. Did you see the movie? Who won the game, you know? Then there's, of course, the large but relatively same over the years topic of the tragedy and elation of personal relationships, which people talk about quite a bit. There's politics, there's religion, maybe nature, a handful of topics that I could think of. But actually, what else is there, you know, besides whatever, in the weather? Yeah. Well, that comes under the category of nature. Yeah. Yeah. Children, well, that's the tragedy and elation of personal relationships. So we could argue about the categories, but what I'm saying is there's a certain finite, relatively, surprisingly small number of topics that human beings converse about and have been conversing about for a long time. Body, well, right, body functions, nature. So anyway, my point is that when you really think about it, what's really going on is, and if you listen to conversations, you'll have this experience, that people are basically repeating the same conversations that have been going on. There's a finite number of conversations. I know people, there's people, famous Russian scholars once studied stories, narratives, and they figured out there was like five stories or whatever it was, that the entire world was telling five stories, and that they were just variations. And then they even like would delineate the variations on those five. There are five stories, and each story has six variations or whatever it was, but basically the same five stories. So I think we've been having the same human conversations for a long time. So I don't know how unique and marvelously different, you know, our lives are. Then, you know, take your own life, which seems so unique. Maybe, you know, our lives are actually just reruns, maybe, of somebody else's life, some other life that happened before. Sometimes I think that. Maybe our lives are kind of replays with a different costume, maybe change the language a little bit, replays of the pattern of suffering and confusion that has already happened before in a new form, slightly different form. So maybe this is really, all of this way of experiencing our life is really the realm of the eighth consciousness that I was talking about the other day, the storehouse consciousness, the big mind that we all participate in, which contains all human experience and all experience. So in so far as we're living in the sixth consciousness and the seventh consciousness, the functioning of mind in relation to objects and the sense of an observing self, we might see ourselves as unique individuals. But insofar as the source of all that is the eighth consciousness, perhaps our lives are more like another wave breaking in the ocean of being. Now, I don't know what you think when you hear that. What do you think? Oh, that is very depressing. You know what I mean, like, what's the point? If that's what it is. Maybe you feel that way. But to me, it's not at all depressing. I find it quite wonderful and liberating to feel that this is not just about my little life, that I'm here, you know, all by myself for such a short little time between the time I'm born and the soon time coming when I'm dead. Here I am, you know, alone with my little life that maybe doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I'm not really getting anywhere, and that's it. I much more feel happy to think that my little life is part of a big musical symphony of life, that all together we make kind of beautiful music, like a symphony with repetitions and structure that each of us participates in somehow. So for me, looking at my life in that way makes me feel more complete, more settled, more confident. It makes me feel that there's more meaning to know that my life touches all that, and all of that touches me. So back to the, I was in the middle here of the, what was it? Oh yes, the knots. The knots that must be untied from the center. So there's more talk about the knots and the different ways that there are to untie the knots. And then comes a very long section of the sutra where the Buddha says to the assembly, in answer to this question of what are the different ways that you could get to the center of the knot and untie the knot, he says, well, assembly, you people are all, you know, enlightened bodhisattvas. Why don't you tell me what your favorite way is of untying the knot? And then, one after the other, 25 bodhisattvas each stand up and each say what their favorite way of untying the knot is, which takes about, I don't know, 100 pages or so. So, I will give you a few selections, just to give you some examples of the types of things that they say. And they go through the seven elements and the six sense organs, and each one, you see, standing, his favorite way is a particular element or a particular sense organ and so forth. Here's one that some of you might appreciate. This is a Bhadrapala, who stands up with 16 awakened arhats, who were his buddies. All 17 of them stand up at the same time. And they bow to the Buddha and they say, we first heard the Dharma and left the home life under King of Awesome Sound Buddha. That was the name of the Buddha, King of Awesome Sound. A long time ago, this Buddha, that's when we first began our practice. One time, it was time to take a bath, and I followed the Sangha, the custom of the Sangha, and entered the bathhouse, and entered into the water, and suddenly, when I went into the water, I awakened to the fact that water does not wash away the dust, nor does it cleanse the body. In other words, what he's saying is, I just let go of all my ideas about taking a bath and just actually experienced completely the sensation at the center of the knot of the feeling of being immersing my body in water. At that point, I became peaceful, and I attained the state of there being nothing at all. And that's how I became enlightened and disciple of the Buddha. So, you asked Buddha about different ways of untying the knot, about perfect penetration. I think touch is the best way to be enlightened by the sensation of touch. So, I tell this story because some of you might know that if you ever go to the Zen Center and take a bath or go to a shower, there's a picture there of the 16, the Bhadrapala and the 16 arhats who attained enlightenment on entering the bath. There's a little picture there. And you bow to that picture and say gata when you go to the bath. So I thought, for those of you who know about that, I'd tell you that's where that picture comes from the Shirangama Sutra. So, likewise, there are bodhisattvas who are enlightened by sight, sound, smell, touch. There's a whole bunch of doctors who make potions, you know, like medicines, and they become enlightened by the sense of taste. But then here's another one that I thought you might be interested in. Let's see, what's the name of this one? Yeah. Kshudra Pantaka. Kshudra, it's hard to say these word names. Kshudra Pantaka arose from his seat, bowed to the Buddha, and said, I am deficient in the ability to memorize, and I'm kind of stupid. When I first met the Buddha, I heard the Dharma, and I left the home life, but I was saying, you know, people memorize all these texts and all that. Well, I couldn't memorize very well, and I tried to memorize like one line, and I couldn't do it. I spent 100 days trying to memorize that one line, and if I remembered the first part, I'd forget the last part. Or if I remember the last part, then I'd forget the first part. The Buddha took pity on my stupidity and taught me to relax and regulate my breath. I contemplated my breath thoroughly to the subtle point in which arising, dwelling, change, and extinction happen on each moment. My mind suddenly attained vast non-obstruction until my outflows were extinguished and I accomplished arhatship. And I became a Buddha. So if you ask about the perfect way to untie the knot at the center, it's turning the breath back to emptiness. That's the foremost method. So, since I so often talk about the breath, and so many of us practice with the breath, this is where this bodhisattva, you know, is the champion of that practice. Very stupid bodhisattva. Master Hua, in his commentary, says that this bodhisattva also was enlightened by sweeping, that he couldn't remember anything. He couldn't, I guess, maybe he couldn't even follow his breath, so he just started sweeping. And Buddha said, just say broom. And he said, broom, 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 sweep, sweep. And he became enlightened by sweeping. So sweeping is also, that's one reason why sweeping is such an honored practice in Zen. You know, the practice of just sweeping, 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 sweeping. Let's see. So I'm just, this is just some selections. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, outflows. Someone asked before. Outflows is a grabby relationship to what's outside. And I was trying to think, I think there's four outflows, and I can't, maybe somebody here knows. One is sense desire, outflowing when you have a sensory experience, rather than just the experience is there and passes away, you have a grabby feeling about it. You want more of it, or it's not quite enough for you. Or you want to run away from it. Another one is doubt. Doubt is an outflow. When you rather than accepting what arises, what comes in, you push it aside, you doubt it. Ill will is another one. When ill will arises and you're caught by ill will, that's an outflow. Anybody remember what the fourth one is? Somewhere here in the text, but I couldn't find it. Anyway, it's not important. All together, they're really variations of, they're the opposite of allowing experience to just be there and having a kind of settled patient acceptance of what is. Maybe that sounds familiar. Maybe that's it. Yeah. But whatever it is, it's the main point is you can see all of these ill will, doubt, sense experience, desire for becoming. They're all variations on the theme of non-acceptance, non-settledness with what is. So, to dry up the outflows or get rid of the outflows is to have a settled acceptance of what is, which transforms what is. Because what is gets distorted by the outflows. Anyway, I thought one more of these 25 bodhisattvas. The bodhisattva named Maintaining the Ground arose from his seat, bowed at the Buddha's feet, and said to the Buddha, I remember when Universal Light, a Buddha named Universal Light, appeared in the world in the past. I, at that time, was a monk who continually worked on making level the major roads, ferry landings, and the dangerous spots in the ground where the disrepair might hinder or harm carriages or horses. I did everything from building bridges to hauling sand. I was diligent in this hard labor throughout the appearance of that Buddha. If there were beings at the walls and gates of the cities who needed someone to carry their goods, I would carry them all the way to their destination, set the things down, and leave without taking any recompense. When the Buddha Vipassyan appeared in the world, there was a worldwide famine. I would carry people on my back, and no matter how far the distance, I would only accept a small coin. If there was an ox cart stuck in the mud, I would use my spiritual strength to push the wheels and get it out of difficulty. Once a king asked the Buddha to accept a vegetarian feast. At that time, I served the Buddha by leveling the road as he went. The Vipassyan Buddha rubbed my head again and said, "You should level your mind ground. Then everything else in the world would be level." Immediately my mind opened up and I saw that the particles of earth composing my body were no different from all the particles of earth that made up the world. The nature of those particles of dust was such that they did not connect with one another, nor could they be touched by the blade of a sword. And I awakened to the patience with the non-production of dharmas and accomplished arhatship. So he says, the foremost way then of untying the knot is to contemplate earth, contemplate physicality. And so he was a worker person, a person working, and that's why that became his practice. And there was another one who contemplated water and attained awakening through meditating on the nature of water. So much so that when he sat in meditation, and somebody, one of his disciples came to see him. He looked in the room, the disciple did, and he didn't see anything there except a big lake. Didn't see the person, it was just like a lake. So he for some reason, he was like a kid, you know, and a kid sees a lake, they think, let's throw a stone in. So he threw a stone in the lake. And, you know, he went away. And then when the bodhisattva came out of his water meditation, he said, "Ow! Oh!" He had a terrible pain in his chest. And it turned out to be the stone that was stuck in his chest. So then he had to go back in meditation, and he said to the kid, "Now, next time you go by there and you see this lake, you have to jump in the lake. You have to get that stone and take it out." So the kid did that, and then he felt better. Anyway, there's lots of interesting stories in there. But now I want to tell you the last of the 25 stories, because, of course, the last of the 25 stories is the most important one, the best of all, the most ultimate of the ultimate story. Then, Guan Yin, Bodhisattva, arose from her seat, bowed at the Buddha's feet, and said, "World-honored one, I remember when, as many kalpas ago as there are sands in the Ganges, there was a Buddha in the world named Hearing the World's Sounds," which is what Guanyin means. It also has the same meaning as Kanzeon or Kanjizai. So when we chant the Kanzeon Sutra, it actually means hearing the sounds of the world. So hearing the sounds of the world, Bodhisattva says, I remember a long time ago there was a Buddha named Hearing the Sounds of the World. And it was under that Buddha that I brought forth my resolve to practice. And that Buddha taught me to enter samadhi through a process of hearing and listening. Initially, I entered the flow through hearing and forgot objective states. In other words, I entered through hearing and I let go of the idea of objects. I didn't experience objects anymore. Since the sense objects and sense organs were quiet, two characteristics of movement and stillness crystallized and did not arise. The whole world became quiet. After that, gradually advancing, the hearing and what was heard both disappeared. Once the hearing was ended, there was nothing to rely on, and awareness and the objects of awareness became empty. When the emptiness of awareness reached an ultimate perfection, emptiness and what was being empty then also ceased. Since production and extinction were gone, still extinction, in other words, complete, total extinction, that was not the opposite of production, arose. Suddenly, I transcended the mundane and transcendental worlds, and throughout the 10 directions, a perfect brightness prevailed, and I obtained 2 supreme states. First, I was united with the fundamental, wonderfully enlightened mind of all the Buddhas of the 10 directions, and I gained a strength of compassion equal to that of all the Buddhas, the thus come ones. So, upward, I united with all the Buddhas, and I had the compassion of all the Buddhas and the same strength of all the Buddhas. Second, I was united below with all living beings in the 6 paths. In other words, even beings in hell realms, in terrible suffering, those beings also, all the beings in all the realms, I was united with them. And I gained a kind regard for all living beings equally. World-honored one, because I served and made offerings to the thus come one, Guanyin, who also I am, I received from that thus come one a transmission of the Vajra Samadhi of all being like an illusion, as one becomes permeated with hearing and cultivates hearing. Because I gained a power of compassion identical with that of all Buddhas, the thus come ones, I became accomplished in 32 response bodies and entered all lands. And then long on and on and on about all his different powers and accomplishments and ways in which Guanyin can help sentient beings. On and on. That just calling out the name of Guanyin can avert disasters and cause enlightenment and help you in all kinds of ways, you know, like whatever you need, you just call out to Guanyin and you'll get it. Guanyin has these powers because of the perfection of this meditation on hearing sound in the way that she describes here. So you see that this practice of listening, deeply, deeply listening. And in this passage I just read for you, there's just a suggestion as to how deep and profound a practice it is. The surprise is that this practice is the fountainhead of compassion. Who would have imagined that the fountainhead of compassion comes from deep listening to the profundity of the world? That the best way of untying the knots of the senses and seeing that the world of confusion really is the world of liberation, that the best way is hearing the sounds of the world, listening with receptivity to the world's sounds and to the cries of suffering in the world. And in the end, this is what compassion really is. Just that deep, deep, open listening without outflows, without grasping. When you listen, really and truly listen, in the deep sense that Guanyin speaks of it in the sutra, then compassionate activity follows from this very naturally. Really, you can't point out something as compassion and something that's not compassion. Based on this practice of listening, you see that the unfolding of life itself is just compassion. The whole drama of the universe in all of its color and tragedy is really a drama of compassion. I'm sure some of you know the wonderful koan about this. In this sutra, I didn't read this passage, but Guanyin, among the many things that she speaks about, is her capacity to proliferate heads. She can have one head, two heads, 20 heads, 30 heads, and also hands and eyes. The passage goes on. I can have 10 eyes, 50 eyes. And maybe some of you know there are many depictions. This Guanyin statue that we have on our altar has one head and two eyes and two hands. But there are many depictions of Guanyin with numerous heads, one piled on top of the other, and numerous arms, because the sutra speaks of this. So there's a koan about this idea and this practice of Guanyin. And it involves the same two monks I mentioned the other day, Yunyan and Dawu, when I told you the story of Yunyan sweeping and holding up a broom and saying, "Which moon is this?" These were two monks who were good buddies and always often brought up the Dharma together. And a number of stories where they together discuss. Anyway, once Yunyan asked Da Wu, "Guanyin has so many hands and eyes. What are all those hands and eyes for? What does she do with all those hands and eyes?" And Da Wu said, "It's like somebody reaching back for their pillow in the dark." And Yunyan said, "I understand." Da Wu said, "What do you understand?" And Yunyan said, "The body is covered with hands and eyes." And Da Wu said, 80% right." And Yunyan said, "What do you say?" And Da Wu said, "The whole body is nothing but hands and eyes." So reaching back for your pillow in the dark is something reflexive and natural. You know, if you wake up in the middle of the night and reach back for your pillow, you don't think about, calculate about it, you know, and you don't say, maybe I'll reach back for my pillow. Would that be a good idea? That would be nice, you know. You don't think, it just happens. It's just a reflex of your waking up. And compassion is like that. And it's not something extra, you know, hands and eyes stuck onto you, something extra. It is you. It is your activity. All of your activity, not just the activity that somebody would say, oh, look, that's a compassionate action. Actually, from your point of view, there are only compassionate actions. You don't think, oh, look how compassionate I was yesterday when I went and did this nice thing for somebody. You just do things. Live your life. And loving kindness and compassion arise naturally in your activity without any sense of deliberation or definition as compassion. So I hope that you have already found and will continue to find in the future that in this very direct and technical sense that we've been practicing it, but even in a wider and broader sense, the practice of listening to the world, profoundly listening to the world without outflows, without grabbiness, without running away, is a true, true practice. To listen to yourself, truly listen to yourself with that same kind of spaciousness, and to listen to others with that same kind of spaciousness. And if you can listen with a sympathetic, loving presence to yourself and to others, knowing that everything is compassion. Everything, in other words, everything, no matter how negative it may seem, has the power to heal. If you can listen with that sense, then even in impossible situations, and goodness knows there are impossible situations in this life, even in impossible situations there can be some sense of peace and healing. When you yourself or someone else is ill or on the deathbed, or in deep despair or confusion, we think right away, let's fix that. Let's run around. We can do something. Let's make that better. Somehow we can make that better. What can we do here? I remember when my mother was dying, I have an aunt, you know, who was there, and she was constantly running around, plumping up the pillow and fixing the covers and all this, and, you know, let's do something. Let's make it better. And I know now I have a friend who's in the hospital. And hospitals are very noisy places, did you know? I don't think I've ever been in a hospital. I mean, I've been in a hospital as a visitor, but I don't think I've ever been hospitalized. I think that's right. I was born in a hospital, I guess. But so I didn't know this so much, but now I'm realizing from friends that it's extremely noisy, because everybody's always fussing, doing things, you know, let's fix this, do that, oh, let's check this. So people are doing things, fussing. Sometimes, you know, you can do something, but a lot of times it doesn't do any good. So if you can stop fussing, running around, doing things, try to make things better, and just listen with a sympathetic, loving presence. Just be there. Be willing to be there without outflows, accepting the conditions as they are, which means transforming the conditions, deepening them. Then something happens that's not about doing something. Some healing, transformative power arises. And what that is Kuan Yin sneaking in and offering her aid. So this practice of living that we're trying to practice this week is wide and broad and has that capacity and that dimension. Not only on your cushions, but if you can develop that listening heart, it really will help you in your life in many, many ways. So after Guan Yin's lengthy speech, then the Buddha says, well, now we heard 25 different practices. Which one is the best? Let's see. Manjushri, would you stand up and tell us what you think the best one is? So Manjushri stands up. and begins a speech. He says, in verse, of course, "The sea of enlightenment in nature is perfect and clear. Complete, distinct Bodhi is a miraculous source. When basic brightness shone so that objects appear, with objects' existence the brilliance ceased and confusion and falseness came about." Then there's about 20 more pages like that. And then he says, "I now say this, Buddha. In this land, the true substance of teaching resides in hearing the sounds purely. If one wants to attain samadhi, hearing is the best way to enter. Apart from suffering, liberation is found. How excellent is the one who contemplates the world's sounds." And then the last thing that happens at the end of Volume 5 is that a nun whose name is Nature practices hearing the sound of Manjushri reciting those verses. And she becomes fully awakened. But the nice thing about it is that that nun named Nature is actually Matangi's daughter. So she far surpasses at that moment Ananda, who's still, you know, in the next chapter going to be saying, "Buddha, I don't get it, please help." She's called, her name is Nature, the nun, and she has perfect understanding and transcendence at that moment. So that's the end of, so we've done five volumes of the sutra. And I'll end with another poem that I wrote about the Shirangama Sutra. "This world, so natural, seen in its disguise of sadness and desire. A transcendence built of light within the surrounding darkness. Water, earth, and sky hold each other a tilt. The world is gray, and islands proliferate. This seems rhetorical, cut and spliced into a breathtaking panorama that denies pretense, but admits artifice, almost requires it, so that contemplation allows it for a moment to be self-forgotten and free, till a moment later, the calculator, inspired by clock notions, schemes its way toward intersecting establishments, borders and bridges abound. This world, so natural, seen in its disguise of sadness and desire, a transcendence built of light within the surrounding darkness. Water, earth, and sky hold each other a tilt. The world is gray, and islands proliferate. This seeing's rhetorical, cut and spliced into a breathtaking panorama that denies pretense, but admits artifice, almost requires it, so that contemplation allows it for a moment to be self-forgotten and free, till a moment later, the calculator, inspired by clock notions, schemes its way toward intersecting establishments. Borders and bridges abound."